ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Yeah, I think it was a real taking out the trash week, trying to solve all their problems at the same time and deal with all the stinky stories this week.
My government is concerned with the fight against inflation. Peter Dutton's concerned about fighting culture wars.
And I think if the Prime Minister wants to renege on an election commitment he's taken to the last two elections, I think you should call an election.
The housing system is cooked in this country.
And I was praying that the Minister and the government would finally wake up to themselves and do the right thing.
Hello and welcome to The Party Room. I'm Patricia Carvalis from RN Breakfast and Q&A, joining you from Wurundjeri country here in Melbourne.
And g'day, I'm David Lipson, host of PM, joining you from the lands of the Ngunnawal and Gambri people here in Canberra. Of course, filling in for the wonderful Fran Kelly.
And David, lovely to have you co-hosting. I'm looking forward to it.
Yes.
Last night I went to bed and I was like, oh, David, how exciting. And also because there's so much to talk to you about, such an incredibly hectic week. I just spoke to, you know, somebody in the government who said to me, which I think speaks volumes, hey, you'd have to say, on balance, we didn't exactly win this week, did we? And I just laughed out loud, like, no shit, Sherlock, sorry, but keep that in. It was a really ugly week for the government. But there is kind of a new angle and another difficulty that kind of emerged at the end of the week, which very much will be an issue for the federal government as well. And David, we should start on that. The news that the NT government has imposed a 14-day curfew on young people, on youth in Alice Springs, that follows a spike in youth crime and violence in the town. It means anyone under the age of 18 on the streets after six will be rounded up, taken home or to a safe place. But it just demonstrates kind of the crisis point that Alice has got to. The federal senator, Jacinta Namba-Jimba-Price, has called on the federal government to send in the ADF and also pushing the prime minister to come to Alice. All of those dimensions are back in the debate. You remember that was playing out a little bit last year during the referendum campaign, so everyone will recall that. Mm. Then I spoke to the Labor MP for the federal seat of Lingiari on Breakfast, Marion Scrimshaw, who has long been calling for bans to alcohol. And you know, she's certainly somebody who has taken really strong positions. And here she is speaking to me.
I think right across Australia, and I've said this before, I think it's time for maybe National Cabinet to convene with First Ministers of each state and territory to start looking at the issues of youth across this country.
So, David, she's calling even for the Prime Minister to essentially convene a meeting where national youth crime is top of the agenda. Mm. Clearly, this is going to be something that the Prime Minister has to get involved in.
It's looking more and more like that. Obviously, crime is in the remit of the states. It's not normally a federal government responsibility. But obviously, the Northern Territory is different. As with the ACT, there's a lot more federal government involvement in terms of funding and the like. I think this certainly has the potential to be a very difficult position for the federal government. The government's already vulnerable on Indigenous issues after the loss of the Voice referendum. And the opposition, Peter Dutton, you know, he's been right on top of this youth crime story from the start. He, you know, spent a lot of time in Alice Springs a few months back, and he is already pointing out that the Prime Minister has only spent a matter of hours in Alice Springs in the last little while. Of course, the Labor government has thrown quite a bit of money at the problem, but clearly this hasn't worked. And more broadly, youth crime is such a massive issue right now, right across Australia. And it was one of the key issues, I was told, in the massive swing against Labor in Queensland in the recent council elections. One Labor strategist told me recently it's still almost entirely seen as a state responsibility. Voters are separating it. But as I say, the Northern Territory is not a state. It gets a lot of support from Canberra. And now with these calls for the federal government to step in a more serious way, it is – a tricky problem because of all the history of obviously federal government intervention in the Northern Territory.
Yeah, and to be fair to the federal government, since the loss of the referendum, you know, I think it was lost a bit for a while, and I still think there are moments where it's lost, don't get me wrong. I don't think it's got all of its agenda ready, but it did make some significant announcements around housing significantly and also education. Now Marion Scrimgeour says...
They're long burn projects though,
absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely. And
this is a crisis now.
This is a crisis now on the streets. People don't feel safe, and if you look at the pictures, you understand why. But these are intergenerational and deep-rooted issues, so you need the kind of immediate circuit breaker. That's the point of the youth curfew, whether you support it or not. That's the concept behind it, but then you need something deeper. Anyway, we'll park it because I think there'll be more... that does emerge, and we'll see if the two-week curfew becomes longer, what the Prime Minister has to say, because I do think even in his own ranks, Marion Scrimgeour's intervention is significant, because in his own ranks there are people saying, hey, you know, we need to do these sorts of things. So let's move on to what was the government really having what I think is nothing short of a humiliating defeat on the immigration detention bill. It tried to ram through the bill through the Senate, but the coalition formed an unusual alliance with the Greens and the crossbench and voted to delay that Senate vote until May. It goes now off to a Senate committee hearing for more questions to be answered about the bill. Just on the detail quickly, the legislation would give extraordinary powers to the immigration minister, allowing them, whoever it is at the moment, it's to essentially deport non-citizens who have exhausted all legal avenues or to face up to 5 years in jails potentially. And it's been denounced from human rights groups and also some of the crossbench refugee organisations say it's draconian. It certainly is quite hardline legislation. I don't know anyone who would dispute that. The crossbencher Zali Steggall called the process undemocratic. Here's what the Home Affairs Minister Claire O'Neill had to say.
This is one of the most common sense things that I have seen come before the Parliament. How can we have a situation where we have no legal power to compel people to work with us to remove them from the country when they have no right to be here? Now, it's very disappointing, and I want the Coalition to come forward and give us a clear explanation about what their policy issues are with the bill that was before the Parliament, because I've listened to them this week and I haven't yet heard one.
Whoa. Okay. So, David, hard, tough line from Claire O'Neill. What went wrong?
Well, I think the government was probably trying to be too clever here. I think, you know, they were clearly trying to rush this through to avoid it becoming a spectacle and a kind of drawn out debate on the nightly news. They appear to have sort of tried to bring out the wedge against the coalition, expecting they would just fall into line because they ultimately support this type of approach. But that wedge kind of hit a brick wall. And all of this comes in the frame of this High Court case, which is coming down the pipeline, of an Iranian man known as ASF-17. We can't identify the man. He's refusing to cooperate with authorities who want to deport him. And the government is nervous about what that ruling could mean. So it's trying to put these safeguards in place. It's trying to do it urgently. But look, this draft bill, we understand, was drawn up on Friday. They waited till Tuesday on a very busy day to sort of drop this on the coalition and say, urgently pass it. The coalition passed it through the lower house, but said, hang on a minute, we want more scrutiny on this for the upper house. And I think the coalition's calculation, despite the tough on borders rhetoric, is to oppose this bill and increase the pressure on the Albanese government for as long as possible before, I mean, we'll see what happens, but you would expect ultimately they would support it.
Yeah, they want to drag this out. That's part of what this is. There's definitely a lot of loaded politics in all of this, David. they want to be on their turf, and on their turf is national security, immigration. They want to be talking about that as long as they can. And they have been, I think, quite successfully painting Labor as chaotic during this period, you know, painting them as having a series of blunders in the immigration space. They've been targeting the immigration minister. We've seen them do this really repeatedly over the last few months, mounting attacks, calling the immigration minister to resign, now refusing to pass the bill. And they say that they have good reason for not passing this because a lot of their key questions were not answered by officials, by Home Affairs. workers adequately. Paul Karp, the chief political correspondent for The Guardian, is going to get into it a bit more with us because it is, I think, one of the biggest stories of the week and beyond for the government. Mm. But let's just get to another front because I can't tell you how many stories have emerged this week.
It's been a week.
like, really, it's that real take out all of your trash in the week before.
Barnacle clearing.
Oh, every barnacle. All right, so another front. The government unveiling its long-awaited draft legislation, which paves the way for sweeping reforms, this time to the NDIS after the NDIS review. It will include moving from a diagnosis-based to a needs-based assessment to enter the scheme. It increases the length of plans to 5 years, more flexibility in budgets, increasing the power of the industry watchdog to crack down on dodgy providers. But David, what really was an issue this week is the premiers, because there was a deal done late last year over funding. The government wants to rein in, the federal government, that is, the growth of the NDIS. It's been growing. They want the states to do more heavy lifting. States seem to agree, but what's happened?
Well, the deal was done in good faith by the state premiers and chief ministers back in December. They were expecting to be shown the detail on this. Now that some of the detail has come through, and it's not all, they're worried that they're going to be left carrying the can when it comes to cost blowouts on the NDIS, because a lot of the control, all of the control really, as to who is going to end up on the NDIS system and who is going to end up in the state system in the future is ultimately, at this point, up to the federal government. So the chief ministers and premiers penned a letter calling on the government to delay the legislation until further consultation. And the premiers say they just haven't been told who is going to be moved to these foundational supports, as they're known, that is the existing kind of state system and new supports that'll crop up there. They're just worried about putting additional strain on an already strained system, that is health and education in the states. Here's the New South Wales Premier, Chris Minns.
I accept that there's exponential costs increasing in the NDIS, but if it means that there's going to be cost shifting onto the states and more pressure on our hospital system in particular, well, I need to know and quantify what those costs are going to be.
And support from the states is obviously critical to actually implementing these changes. Bill Shorten, the Minister for the NDIS and Government Services, sought to quash concerns over this. He suggested the agreement will be achieved and that this is just early days, this is just the foundations of the legislation, and that there's plenty more consultation to come.
And that consultation, I think we know, is going to be hard because the premiers have told us that's the case.
And well, they're so united against it at this point. So, you know, that's a pretty clear signal.
Strap in, everybody. Seems like the perfect time to bring in our guest. Should we do it?
Okay.
Paul Karp is the chief political correspondent for Guardian Australia. He's been knee-deep in the politics of chaos this week. Welcome to the party room.
Thanks for having me.
Great to have you here in the studio with me, Paul, PK. I spoke briefly about the government's failed immigration detention legislation a bit earlier, but I want to go to the timeline here, as in why did the government introduce this at this time? Because it happened on this very busy day. There was, you know, electric vehicles legislation. There was talk around religious discrimination, the NDIS. It felt a little bit to me watching on like Steve Bannon's strategy to sort of flood the zone with shit, if you like. There was so much news going on and not all of it good for the government. What did you think of the timing, Paul?
Yeah, I think it was a real taking out the trash week, trying to solve all their problems at the same time and deal with all the stinky stories this week. And then hopefully on the other side of Easter, you know, budget drops and talking about the clean energy transition. They were hoping to get a lot of this stuff through this week. The offshore gas bill they were hoping would be done and dusted. The deportation bill they were hoping to have coalition support and it would be through already. But on so many of these things, the best laid plans have not come off. They've been delayed and there's still, you know, weeks and months of pain more in these issues for them.
Pain is a perfect word for it. The opposition was originally expected to pass the legislation. reluctantly, but still. Instead, they formed what was a bit of an unusual alliance with the Greens, although the government will tell you, oh, they're always, you know, lining up with the Greens. That's one of their lines. They claimed there could be, this is the coalition now, they claimed there could be unintended consequences and there needed to be more scrutiny.
Coalition senators basically begged the government to demonstrate why it was so urgent, why it had to be rushed through the parliament in 36 hours, and they failed to do so. They couldn't explain how many people this would affect. They couldn't explain what the consequences of this would be for any upcoming High Court cases.
It's clear the opposition wants to compound the pressure on the government over immigration. There's no disputing. It suits them politically to do so. But have they got real concerns too, Paul?
Well, the objection that they've expressed is that maybe the ban on new visa applications from whole countries that don't take forced returns like Iran, Iraq and South Sudan, that maybe that might create unintended consequences, that people might go to Indonesia, then come on boats to Australia, which seems a bit far-fetched. I do think that it is largely just prolonging the pain. We did see at the end of last year, the coalition tried to set up an inquiry into the mishandling of the High Court case with the Greens, but the Greens said, no, you're just doing this to demonise refugees and asylum seekers. We won't be part of this. But this time, their interests align because the Greens have real concerns with the bill. They're desperate to stop it. The coalition might pass it in 6 weeks' time, but they're desperate to keep it going as an issue, so the stars aligned.
What happens, Paul, though, when this High Court hearing happens next month? We don't know whether there'll be a ruling, but if there is and it results in a whole bunch more detainees being released, where does the political pressure land? Is it somewhat spread between the opposition and the government?
Yeah, so on the 17th of April, the High Court's hearing a case about whether if people don't cooperate with their deportation, that is an excuse for the government to keep them in detention. And I reported last week, based on a leaked internal document, that there's more than 170 people that are in detention that could benefit from that decision if it goes the way the plaintiff instead of the Commonwealth. So I think what this bill is about is, you know, in the event that they lose that, they want the powers to be able to nudge people further along the funnel of getting onto a plane and going to another country. They want to, you know, force people to apply for passports or to remove whatever the obstacle is to them being deported so that they can deal with those people. But yes, I think the risk is for the coalition that if the Commonwealth loses, the government will recall parliament and some of the blame will be on the coalition for not having passed the powers in advance of the hearing.
I think that's right, but equally, it still ultimately always hurts a government most, though, doesn't it, Paul? Because they're kind of in charge and it looks messy on their watch.
Yeah, I think a lot of these things are, for the coalition, heads we win, tails we win. I mean, they forced the government to pass harsher, you know, ankle bracelet and curfew laws to take safeguards out of that bill. Now those bills are under challenge. If the government loses a case on that, the coalition aren't going to accept any responsibility. They'll just say, oh, it's more chaos and the government should have known better than to agree what we were pushing. And again, here, like I don't think they'll take any responsibility. Obviously, we as journalists have to point out that they're acting in their self-interest, but they will try and maximise pain and skate away if there's a loss.
Are there deeper systemic issues here in the Departments of Home Affairs between Claire O'Neill, between the Department Secretary? There's been reports this week, denied, but reports that the Secretary left the Minister's office in tears, that she was given a dressing down. As I say, that part was denied. But also the Immigration Minister, Andrew Giles. What's going on between relationships here?
Yeah, so Stephanie Foster denied that she was verbally abused by the Home Affairs Minister, Claire O'Neill, but she didn't deny that she had negative feedback about her decision and the timing and the lack of notice of tabling the criminal history of the then 149 people who had been released as a result of the High Court's decision on indefinite detention. So I think we can take as given that the government was not happy about that. I actually want to celebrate the independence that she showed in answering those questions and in tabling that information in the first place.
Totally.
And I hope that she's not cowed by that, and she feels that she still can do that despite whatever the interaction was.
Now, it's notable that ministers Claire O'Neill and Andrew Giles didn't really make themselves overly available to explain their legislation this week. And I think the question around accountability is an important one. They did end up doing a press conference, although it was pretty short as far as I could see. It wasn't fulsome. And, you know, we've been trying to get them on all week and it hasn't been successful.
We have too, and other programs too.
They just don't want to explain their legislation or subject themselves to scrutiny. What's going on?
Calling a press conference when you want to get grabs up that the opposition is standing in the way of legislation, but not having called a press conference to explain why the legislation was needed in the first place or to answer the media's questions about how it works. Yeah, they've been dodging interviews left, right and centre. A few perfunctory questions at that press conference to say, you know, Peter Dutton is Dr. No, and then they were off.
This sort of goes to the broader issue of transparency in the government right now. Obviously, Anthony Albanese, before the election, promised to run a more transparent, open, consultative government. And on a number of issues, we're seeing a kind of attempt at command and control, it seems, coming down. If you look at the government's handling, for example, of its religious discrimination legislation, also shrouded in a veil of secrecy. Now, it says it's not going to introduce this bill without bipartisan support. It's giving briefings to members of the opposition, the crossbench, the Greens, but not providing the legislation itself, certainly not releasing it publicly. And those lucky enough to have seen it have actually been forced to sign non-disclosure agreements. Are we seeing anything resembling what Anthony Albanese promised on transparency?
Well, it's not just the rush on the deportation bill and the secrecy of the religious discrimination bill. There's also non-disclosure agreements in the fuel efficiency consultation, the environment law consultation Tanya Plibersek is doing, the National Disability Insurance Scheme legislation Bill Shorten introduced this week. All of those were very secretive processes. It's not unprecedented. I mean, Christian Porter was doing this for his industrial relations consultations, making people sign these, but it's happening more and more. And I don't think it's a healthy development because other stakeholders, other than the few that are selected to be in the room, seeing what the proposal is and commenting on the proposal is part of the accountability. Like the journalists and lawyers and other stakeholders that aren't in the room need to be able to see what the proposal is.
I agree. I think that it's really important that we are able to ask questions about legislation. But I think we get a taste today, we're recording this Thursday morning, of some of the government's concerns. Dozens of religious leaders have written to the Prime Minister declaring it would be a betrayal of trust if he worked with the Greens on the religious discrimination legislation. He's kind of fighting fires everywhere at the moment on this legislation. Where are we at on this one, Paul?
I think that Anthony Albanese's assessment was correct, that if he went the crossbench route, he would get blasted by stakeholders like the National Catholic Education Commission. So I think he got the judgment right that he probably needed bipartisan support from the coalition if he was to avoid criticism from religious groups. But the problem is that if he wanted to give the appearance of being open to all sides, he gave the game away by saying it's Dutton or nothing and then pretending, actually, I've noticed the Greens and the crossbench still exist. So I think this one is rapidly getting stuck in the ditch. The proposal is more protective of religious freedom than whatever the Law Reform Commission proposed, but not enough for the coalition because they can't stand completely removing the religious exemption to the Sex Discrimination Act. And the crossbench route is unviable because he doesn't want to lose religious stakeholders. So I think it's quickly becoming a standoff.
You think it's looking cooked, right?
I think they're not getting the bipartisan support that they would need to unjam it. Yeah.
I was told by one backbencher in Labor that they potentially could cobble together a deal with the Greens and the crossbench and get that through. But apart from, you know, the blast that they'd get was certainly from the opposition and almost certainly in that case from religious institutions and the like, They're also worried about igniting a culture war that runs right through to the election. That's the claim anyway, that, you know, vulnerable people looking, for example, to the Voice referendum or looking to the same-sex marriage plebiscite, those debates can do real damage even if the legislation itself is, you know, in a place that they want it to be. And I think more pertinently, politically, that would be a big problem for them.
Yeah, it's not like the community cohesion is at an all-time high at the moment, is it? Particularly in the wake of the Gaza war. Hey, I just want to pivot to, I cannot believe how much has been on the agenda. I'm exhausted just thinking about it, but we have to talk about the fuel efficiency standards. The government tabled them on Wednesday. It comes after a consultation period The government essentially watered down its original proposal. Now, the laws aim to increase the number of electric vehicles in Australia. The government has already conceded some pretty big carve-outs, I reckon. Larger vehicles like utes and big SUVs like Toyota Land Cruisers will be categorised as light commercial vehicles. So that, you know, that scare campaign that they would cost a whole lot more can be dampened, if you like. Paul, what did you make of the come down from the original proposal?
Well, I think the architecture is still mostly there. There's still going to be a fuel efficiency standard and a system of penalties if car makers exceed those, and credits for car makers that come in with more efficient vehicles that come under that bar. So the architecture is still there. They've been slightly more generous about what those standards are and slower in bringing them in. But they're still getting most of the emissions reduction and building the architecture to do this where currently we have no standards. So if they can get it through, then I think it's a win.
Okay, but to get it through, it's going to be tricky, isn't it? Because the coalition, I don't think, is going to give them a very welcome pathway. And then the Greens have been playing hardball on these issues.
Yeah, the coalition is already a no. So the Greens and crossbench is the only viable pathway. The Greens linked their vote to the offshore gas bill, but that it was more an opportunity than a threat. They were saying, if you take out the bit we dislike from the offshore gas bill, then we will give you the fuel efficiency standards. But the government's calculation is it's very hard to see them voting against the fuel efficiency standards.
So, Paul, we're now staring down the barrel of that long parliamentary break where the government basically is putting together its federal budget. It hopes to, I'm assuming, reset a little after what they all agree has been a pretty messy week. The PM's begun that process. You know, he's out talking about Labor's $1 billion investment in solar panel manufacturing that will turn the Liddell coal-fired power site in the Hunter Valley into a facility that builds the fastest and most efficient panels in the world. That's all part of, like, the switch, isn't it? The reset, trying to kind of go, look at all this work we're doing as they go into this break.
Yeah, I think the government wants to fight the next election on, you know, macroeconomic conditions. They've done well managing the economy and on the energy transition. I think this week was about clearing away issues that they don't want to talk about, culture wars about religion, migration, national security. And we'll see the topics that they actually want to talk about on the other side of Easter when they start doing budget drops, which, you know, should make people happy because it's investing, it's spending.
Yeah, they have said, haven't they, that they are kind of flicking the switch to an extent from an inflationary environment, that is, you know, saving government dollars, to more of a stimulatory environment. The extent of that switch, I guess we will see when the budget's handed down in May.
It's such a tricky balance because I saw ANZ was out the other day saying that the fact that the tax cuts flow from July will be inflationary, so maybe we won't get a rate cut until next year, not this year. And so all of these things are very difficult to balance because the government wants a rate cut or two before the next election.
Well, it's a great time to be a journalist, probably harder to be a politician. Paul, thank you for joining us.
As always, that's why we're on this side of the fence.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Paul.
See
Cheers.
Ya.
We'll move to questions without notice. We'll give the call to the Leader of the Opposition.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Prime Minister.
The bells are ringing. It's our question time, a little less rowdy than the question times I've seen this week. And this one comes from Toad Boy on Twitter. Good name. Are the coalition serious about their pursuit of nuclear energy, or are they just trying to stoke the anti-renewables culture war, David?
Good question. Good question. Look, I think there's obviously a lot of politics at play here, but it's probably a little bit more nuanced than just trying to stoke an anti-renewables culture war. I think there probably is a sizable, I wouldn't say large, but, you know, a reasonably sized element of the community that thinks Australia missed an opportunity to go nuclear a while ago, and they're still kind of hanging on to that. And you have seen some signs in polling in recent weeks and months that even young people are keen on nuclear. There's kind of this attitude that we've got to solve the climate crisis, whatever it takes, and if nuclear will help us get there, then so be it. But when you kind of drill down on the details of nuclear, we know it's very expensive. We know there's a very, very long lead time. And if the opposition, I should say, is talking about the electricity grid being unstable and nuclear being the answer to it, well, we're not going to have nuclear for 15 or 20 years, even if it was approved today and even if there was bipartisanship, which there is not. So this is not something that's going to solve the problems that are coming down the pipeline now. There is potentially, if you speak to the experts, a place for nuclear, but it's very much potentially sometime in about 15 or 20 years. It's being framed by the opposition here as a solution to today's or immediately tomorrow's issues. You know, it's not that.
No. And one of my good political contacts was saying to me, you know, this would be hard to sell, this nuclear idea, with the resources of government. For an opposition, without the resources of government and the resources of government, big departments, big ability to do economic modelling and proper work, thinks they can try and sell this when it is contentious. Yeah, there might be a growing cohort, but it's a small cohort that support it. Good luck to you, right?
Yeah. It's also a bit about the Nats, right, isn't it? Because of this community uprising about the transmission lines that are going to go through rural properties and farms and the like to sort of make the renewables plan work. This is being framed as some sort of solution for that, in that you can plug in nuclear into the existing grid and that can work. And at the same time, please, some of the Liberal seats in the cities, maybe not the inner cities anymore, but in the outer suburbs where there is, you know, some appetite for a net zero policy. But, you know, the experts just say it's not it, you know?
Yeah.
It's not it.
Yeah, it's still can't see them landing it. That's all I'm saying.
Yep.
Keep sending your questions in, because you send good ones. We're especially fond of the voice notes, where you can email them to thepartyroom@abc.net.au.
Remember to follow The Party Room on the ABC Listen app as well, so you will never miss an episode. I certainly don't.
Ah, David, you'll be back. I've enjoyed co-hosting with you. So next time, come back, please.
Anytime.
That's it for The Party Room this week. Next week, we'll be taking a little break. I'm going on a little Easter holiday with my daughters who are on school holidays. But don't fret, because Fran will be back the following week with the wonderful Mel Clark, ABC National Affairs reporter, filling in for me as co-host. And then Fran and I will be together the week after. David, have a terrific Easter break.
You too. Thanks, PK.
See ya.